As we all know, many boys have been killed in war. If we were able to count, it would come to millions. And this includes every country all throughout the world, throughout all time. The question I'd like to ask then is, why did God create these boys? If this is the creation of God, why were millions killed? And as every boy who dies has to have a killer, did God create the boys who were killed? And did God create the killers? You might say that's a rather vicious question, but an important one. The answer to that question is imperative. And we may look at the answers that we are given, and you will find that religion has no answer, absolutely none. The best it can do is to smile and say very piously, "Who are we to question the wisdom of God?" And that's a perfect way to straddle the fence. Science has another answer. Science says God is dead. Even those scientists who believe in God will join the statement that who are we to question the wisdom of God? And so the world goes on watching its boys killed and presuming that God has even created those boys, and possibly that God has even created the boys who killed those boys. This has been going on for centuries. The Sermon on the Mount answers the question, but it does not answer the question as religion answers it, and it does not answer the question as science answers it. It does answer it in a way that can eliminate that killing. And there has never been an answer on this earth to eliminate that killing except in the voice of the Spirit. Now we know that Jesus went up to a mountaintop. But we must see that he did not climb a mountain. We must see that his mountaintop was high consciousness. He certainly didn't stand on the top of a mountain and shout down to the people below. He entered the high consciousness, and when he was set, they came unto him. And he gave them the Beatitudes. And we have learned from the Beatitudes that they were a summary of his way of rebirth. But rebirth from what? Rebirth from the human being who goes out to get killed in war. Rebirth from the human being who gets hit on the freeway. Rebirth from the human being who thinks I have cancer today or tuberculosis tomorrow. Rebirth. And so he said, "I have come to give you a new way of life. Not the old that you're accustomed to. Not the human self that is born and dies, but a new self. Not a self that you will patch up and then pour new wine into an old bottle. Not a garment that has been used and then you put a new patch in it from a new garment. But rather, a totally new self, a reborn self, a self that bears absolutely no similarity to the self that you never were. You see, he was ready not to pull punches, not to compromise, not to be expedient, not to live in a divided consciousness, not to remain separated from the Spirit. The church has been perfectly willing to do that. Science has been perfectly willing to do that. Education has been perfectly willing to do that. Every phase of human life has been perfectly willing to compromise, but not the Spirit that walked the earth named Jesus. And so he said, this is not a message for the timid. This is a message for those who wish to walk the earth in Christ, living in truth, not living in a human sense of righteousness, not living even in human goodness, but living in spiritual identity. And to emphasize that unless we live in spiritual identity, we will not experience the fruits of the Spirit, he clearly said that the salt which has lost its savour will be trodden under the feet of men. And he was referring to the human race. The human race which has lost its identity, its sense of self, having been dwarfed by its separation from the very power of being itself. He believed, and he taught, and he tested, and he proved, and he demonstrated that there is no fallen man. He was bringing back the realization of the great revelation in the first chapter of Genesis that man is the divine image and likeness of God. And then he said, look out at these who have been killed in war. How do you kill the divine image and likeness of God? Look out at these murderers, these adulterers. Look out at those who have been hurt and are suffering. How do you do that to the divine image and likeness of God? He was showing us that those who have been killed, those who have died, those who have robbed, those who have been in pain, those who have shed tears, are not the divine image and likeness of God. Then who are they? If God created man in his image and likeness, endowing them with every divine quality, who are those who suffer? Who are those who kill? And that is why the church smiles and says we cannot question the wisdom of God, and that is why science says God is dead. Because the issue can never be answered by the counterfeit human mind. The counterfeit human mind will always see boys being killed. It will always see cripples. It will always see cancer. It will always see flood and fire and hurricane. And none of these were created by God. And so the Sermon on the Mount contrasts the way of the counterfeit mind the way of the counterfeit consciousness. Ye have heard it said of old. That's what we always know and think and hear from the world around us, from our teachers, from religion, from science, from education, from history, from psychology, from psychiatry, from medicine. Ye have heard it said of old. But I say unto you, and I am not medicine, I am not science, I am not religion, I am none of these things. I must be identified, for I is not even Jesus. This was not Jesus saying, I say unto you. This was I saying, I say unto you. And I is your self. Your high self says unto you every moment of the day, every word that is in the Sermon on the Mount. I, in the midst of you, say unto you. I, the Father within you, say unto you. And then you must say to yourself, shall I follow I, the Father within me, or shall I follow what I have heard of old? And there you have the strife between your true consciousness and your old false consciousness. The warfare between the spirit and the flesh. I is the spirit, and the old way is the flesh. Spirit says to the flesh, I have a better way for you. And the flesh says, I'm too conditioned, too used to the ways of yesterday, too used to the ways where the world sheds tears, too used to pain, too used to suffering, too used to war. I cannot listen to this new I. And so the false human consciousness pierces the Christ every day. It refuses to wear the seamless garment. And both the church and science have lost the way. We will not find our reality with the cosmic toys of science, and we will not find our reality with religion until it accepts, I say unto you. And when this word comes in the midst of you, revealing itself, then you know you have been touched by the Christ. Now, every day seems to bring new experiences from people, beautiful ones, liberation from fear, from want, from doubt. Liberation from all of the things that we have when we are imprisoned only in the consciousness of the flesh, only in the material consciousness. And so the old way again is that material consciousness, and here comes I, the light, seeping through the senses, to bring a new message, a new horizon, a new self, a new way. And we find suddenly that I refuses to countenance good and evil. I refuses to countenance a fallen self. No, I says unto you, there is no fallen self. You have been living in a false sense of self. I am self. I am not fallen. I am the divine image and likeness, and I am the only being. And so we hearken now to the higher self, and it says to us something very strange. Human righteousness is not enough. Human righteousness will not take you into the kingdom of heaven on earth. Your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Or else you will not enter the kingdom of heaven on earth. That is what I in the midst of us says. Who are these scribes? These Pharisees? Are these men of 2,000 years ago? Or do you think we have them with us now? The scribes were the doctors of the law. They were the men who sat in the back chambers, and like our men in the House of Representatives or the Senate, they made the laws. Only these were religious laws. And then they interpreted the laws. They said, this is the law, and you obey it. And the Pharisees said, fine, we do obey it, rigidly, narrowly, completely, our way. And so the Pharisees said, the way to obey the law is to fast, to sacrifice, to tithe. And if somebody hurts you, hit him back. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Sue him if he doesn't pay up. They had their sense of righteousness. It was all based on the false human identity. It wasn't righteousness at all. It was self-righteousness. It was human goodness pursued to its highest form, perhaps. And yet, it was ready to stone an adulteress. So the consciousness of that day and the consciousness of this day are both revealed as the one Pharisaical consciousness. The one consciousness of the scribes. Who are the Pharisees today? Do you not see that every branch of humanhood is a Pharisee? This was the highest and most powerful sect in Judaism. Today there are Pharisees in every church. There are Pharisees in every branch of science. Do it my way. We know. But I say unto you, your righteousness must exceed the righteousness even of the church, even of science, even of medicine, even of psychiatry, even of positive thinking. Your righteousness must exceed all human righteousness. Why? Because until it does, you will be a divided consciousness. You will not be who you are. You will be hiding from yourself. You will be walking in the ways of this world, which is not my Father's kingdom. Now he tells us all about what righteousness is. In our human righteousness, we think it's perfectly proper to retaliate, to give that which we have received in return. In our human righteousness, we like people to know how holy we are, how philanthropic, how good. That seems normal to us and seems justified. In our human righteousness, we like people to know that we are thoughtful and considerate. In our human righteousness, we know we have to acquire things. We have the right to compete. We've been taught to be do-gooders, go-getters, busy people doing things, acquiring things. But a new way dawns when we learn that I, the Spirit within, am going to teach you the way to live without labor, without fear, without killing, without being killed, without robbery, without all of the human degrees of pain and suffering. I, the spirit within, I do not look out at the world from one point called human vision. I do not see the world from the point of a human consciousness. And we find there is a great revelation coming that I am going to change your way of looking at the world. Instead of looking from within your human sense of vision, your human sense of hearing, your human sense of knowing, looking out, I will show you how to look from infinity and to look within. A complete turnabout, a complete reversal in which, looking from the infinite self, we look at the world within it and see only that which is within the infinite. There is no killing in the infinite. There is no war. There is no pain. There are no tears. There is no death. There is no limitation. There is no lack. And if you would be righteous, because your righteousness must exceed all human righteousness, there is only one kind of righteousness that can be righteous. It is the righteousness of spirit. Only in spiritual righteousness do we fulfill this request of I, that our righteousness exceed the scribes and the Pharisees. There is no human righteousness in spirit. There is no me who can be righteous. You cannot, as a human being, be righteous and fulfill this requirement of the Spirit. And so, quite clearly, I is saying, you must change from that human sense of self to your spiritual identity. For only in your spiritual identity can you be righteous beyond the scribes and the Pharisees. That is how I, in the midst of you, is lifting you into spiritual identity, pushing you beyond the extremes of humanhood into Christhood. And unless our spiritual righteousness is established, we cannot experience the fruits of the Spirit. And now we have the old way, an eye for an eye. But I say unto you, resist not evil. And if someone sues you at the law and wins your coat, give him your cloak as well. How strange. But we're being shown again that in our human consciousness, it is inconceivable that we would say to the person who has won our coat, here, now take our cloak. It is forcing you to the next level of consciousness, a consciousness which says, I recognize no material universe. I recognize spiritual universe as the only universe. And I can do it only because I am spirit. Mortality is the belief under which man labors today. And because he believes in mortality, he sees mortality, he sees death. I say unto you, you must come into the realization of immortality now. In the realization of immortality, we reject every belief, idea, concept, every temptation which even suggests the possibility of a mortal self. You cannot age in the acceptance of immortality. You cannot be sick in the acceptance of immortality. You cannot be a changing creature in the acceptance of immortality. But is there a mortal being on this earth? I know not any. I, spirit, say put on the garment of immortality in the recognition that the divine image and likeness of God is your only name, and the divine image and likeness of God can never be a mortal being. I, if I be lifted up, will lift all men unto immortality realized now. There is nothing but the divine image and likeness of God. And so we are told various ways in which we fall into the trap. That is why you are told to give your cloak if someone wins your coat, so that you will not fall into the trap of thinking of yourself as a mortal being with mortal needs. And let us not think for a moment that the spirit is unaware of our needs. If it tells us to give our cloak, it has a plan. If it says, if someone says to you, walk a mile, walk two, it has a plan. Always, it is revealing to us that we are not limited to the margins of our own consciousness. We are to learn to walk upon the waters of spirit. We are learned to live in complete, absolute confidence that spirit knoweth its needs and fulfills its needs where we stand. All of this is part of the new righteousness, which is really the new self, the new identity, the reunion with that which we have ever been, the divine image and likeness of God. In that reunion, we are resurrected. And that resurrection is the resurrection from that which we have believed ourselves to be, a mortal individual made of flesh and blood, to the realization that the form which I bear is not the beginning of my life. My life did not begin when this form appeared. My life is the divine image and likeness of God, pre-existent to this form, and existent now, and ever existent as that life. All that the Father hath has been embodied in the divine image and likeness of my being. This is called the infinite way because the divine image and likeness of God is an infinite being. And when you have accepted yourself as spirit, immortal, divine, you are automatically accepting infinite reality as your being. And you see, in that acceptance of infinity as your being, you step out of the old consciousness, the old beliefs in righteousness, which said I had to retaliate. I had to be angry when someone did something wrong to me. I had to worry when I lacked or when I was limited. I had to fear what people could do to this body. I had to worry about the calendar. I have to be concerned about germs or nuclear warfare. Why? Because I believe myself to be a mortal being. But I say unto you, your righteousness must end in spiritual righteousness. And then you will know that none of the weapons of this world have power. There is no good and evil. That's the way of the old consciousness. In the new consciousness, the tree of knowledge of good and evil is crucified. We are resurrected into the tree of life. Now, this is just the beginning of the sermon. We are to come out of it with the realization that I am I. That I am self-sufficient in Christ. And that self-sufficiency includes a permanent eternal life fed from within by the infinite Spirit continuously without an interruption in the perfect rhythm of the Father. There is that consciousness which knows I am that I am. I am that infinite Spirit. I am that divine image and likeness. I am the Son. I am the offspring of God. And that consciousness is the consciousness that walked on the earth in the appearance of Jesus, in the appearance of Moses, in the appearance of Buddha, in the appearance of Krishna, in the appearance of Lao Tzu, Shankara, Nanak, many, many others. All were this I, appearing as these enlightened leaders, none of whom said that there is such a thing as death, and all of whom took their bodies with them to prove it. They have been so far ahead of the human consciousness that we have thought of them as specially endowed people, even given some of them the idea of deity, specially chosen. But they were not. They are all the same outer expression of the I that we are. The salt may have lost its savor, but I, the Spirit, am leading the salt back to the realization that it is the light of the Father. This is the message contained in the 5th chapter of Matthew. Now you have noticed, no doubt, that there is a tendency in all of us to downgrade our fellow citizens. It's such an easy thing to do, especially those whom we do not know personally or intimately. We can downgrade the ex-president's wife, the late president's wife, the present president's wife. We may not like things they do. We can downgrade the president. We can downgrade this religion, or this college or that college. We can downgrade just about everybody we know who doesn't agree with us. And that's all out of the human consciousness. If it were possible to invent some kind of a device that you could attach to your hand, and every time you downgraded somebody, this thing would come up and slap you, that would be a marvelous thing. Eventually, we'd stop downgrading people. And the moment we stop downgrading people, we would do precisely what I in the midst of us has been telling us to do for some 10,000 years. It is telling us the most extraordinary and astonishing thing, to love our neighbors, to love even our enemies, to do good to them who despitefully use us. You will search everywhere to find someone who obeys that. To do good to them who despitefully use you. But why does it tell us that if nobody does it? Again, it is telling us that you will never do it as a human being. No human being is capable. The only way you will do it is to lift yourself beyond that human consciousness. And then lo and behold, you'll discover the secret. When you're out of the human consciousness, no one will despitefully use you. They can only do it to a human being. When you are in spiritual consciousness, lo, everywhere is the Christ. Again, the wisdom contained in these words is to lift us beyond the human consciousness. Now we can say, in my new spiritual consciousness, I see no enemy. I see no fool. I see no worthless, contemptible fellow. I see no raka. We are told in one of the messages here in the sermon, not only shall we not kill, but we may not even be angry. We may not even call another individual a worthless, contemptible fool or raka. Because if we do, we will be judged. And what is the meaning of that? Do you see what happens when you call another individual a fool, or the many other adjectives we know so well? You are saying, there goes one who is not the divine image and likeness of God. You have been trapped. There is no such being on this earth. There is no one who is not the divine image and likeness of God. And the moment you have fallen into the trap and declared this one to be a fool and this one to be a swine and that one to be an ignoramus and this one to be contemptible, you have put yourself on a pedestal above God. You have said, God may have said that he created man in his image and likeness. But look at all these exceptions. There are no exceptions. And that's why it was necessary to ask the question, if millions have been killed in war, did God create them? And did God create the killers who killed them? And you must see the human form then as an imagined form. You could not kill that which God had created. You must look beneath the mask of form to see the life that is there. When you look beneath the mask of form to see the life that is there, you will not say contemptible. You will not say scoundrel. You will not say reprobate. You will not say thief. You will not say murderer. You will unmask the form and see the life. And you will not do it in a human consciousness. You will only do it in your true consciousness, I, Spirit. Hidden Christ. One with the Father. Yes? It seems impossible. Be perfect, says the Father, the moment you say it seems impossible. Be perfect as your Father. It is impossible for the human, but I have already crucified the false sense of self. I have already prepared the way. I already have sent out the light that will lead you. I already welcome you into the kingdom of heaven on earth. All you need do is follow I in the midst of you, for I will show you the way to that kingdom. In your own human sense of righteousness, you will fail. And so you must lay aside all that is part of your human sense of righteousness. And once more we feel the subtle way in which spirit prevents us from committing suicide. Spirit says, now drop your false sense of self. Drop the sense mind which knows only the mortal you. Drop the sense mind which knows only the form that someday will be buried. And to make sure we drop the sense mind, spirit catches us at every turn and says, you call him a scoundrel. Why did you think he was a scoundrel? Because your sense mind thought so. He isn't a scoundrel. He's the divine image and likeness. You have a false concept of what he is. Why have you a false concept? Because you are living in your sense mind. Be renewed. Be transformed by the renewing of that mind. The Christ mind will show you that you are surrounded by spiritual being. The Christ mind will show you that where you have seen injustice, justice is. Where you have seen bad health, perfect health is. Where you have seen an aging face, only the spirit stands before you. Our consciousness is being lifted out of the rut of the civilization of the scribes and the Pharisees, out of the compromising human mind, out of the adulterating human sense of things. We are learning to bear witness to truth, to spirit, to identity, to reality, to the immortal universe around us. We are learning to walk with God. All these years that the Bible has been leading us above the righteousness of the human mind has been rebelling like a dog on a leash that refuses to go in the direction you want to go. And so we become very vigilant to that human mind. Every time it opens its mind to think, we learn to say, shh, God is speaking. Listen. Don't talk. Take no thought, little human mind. Take neither an anxious thought or a human thought or any kind of thought. Let God do your thinking for you. Take no thought for your life. And there we have the great passage. The old way was for human minds to decide what was right and what was wrong. The new way says, let God decide. Let the mind of the Father in you decide. Let the shepherd within do all your thinking. In other words, live in the mind of Christ. Now that mind will never look out and judge this world. That mind will never look out and be in need of anything. That mind will never say, today I lack. Today I have not. Today there is something that I must have that I don't have. The Christ mind will never say these things because the Christ mind is self-sufficient. And as long as you find yourself needing, lacking, wanting, desiring, you are still in the limited human mind, and you need not be. You need only remember that the limited human mind is not my mind. I am not that mortal self with a limited human mortal mind. The Christ mind is now my mind. I'm not falling into the trap. I haven't banished God from earth. I'm not selling the idea that man has to wait until he dies to go to heaven. We haven't banished God from this earth by such a declaration. God is this earth. And we are seeing our false concept of it. God is the one mind. And that mind has individualized itself as the Christ mind of every individual on this earth, already finished now. That's our spiritual bank, but we haven't drawn upon it. We have accepted the limited human mind, the mind that is separate from the divine mind, and we have labored, we have struggled, we have sought survival, all because of this false mind and its false thought and its false sense of righteousness. Where is the Christ mind? Is there a place where it is not? If God is all, and God is the Father, and God is the Son, where is the Christ mind? Omnipresent. Draw upon it. Like Niagara Falls, you're standing right in front of Lake Erie. The falls will continue to flow as long as Lake Erie is there. You have no lack or limitation as long as divine mind stands where you stand. But if we are not aware that the divine Christ mind stands where we stand, that divine Christ power stands where we stand, that divine Christ all-knowing stands where we stand, we limit ourselves to our own human resources, our own human sense of things. And the Pharisee in the midst of us dwarfs us down to a dying individual. I have. I am. There's no future tense. I accept. And so we look at every claim now as the tempter. The human mind tempting us to make us believe there is no I. There is no Christ. There is no God. There is no infinite self functioning here. There's just a limited mortal being. That's what the human mind keeps telling us. But I say unto you, ye are the light. And don't hide your light. You must put it on a candlestick and hold it up. You must have a spiritual consciousness in spite of all claims to the contrary. I met a young lady the other day who said she was studying positive thinking. I asked her if it worked. Well, that was a strange question because she didn't expect that question. She thought about it, and while she was thinking, I said, well, have you ever been sick? Oh, yes, I've been sick. Well, have you ever heard that in the Bible it says, take no thought for your life? I don't believe it, she said. I don't believe it. Oh, it really does, I told her. There's a place in the Bible where it says that. Take no thought for my life? Yes. I've got to see it to believe it. So I showed it to her. Next question was, you mean I can't even think about what meals I'm going to serve? No, it doesn't mean that. It means you don't have to take thought for your real life. And of course, I knew before I had started that I wasn't going to get anywhere, nor was I trying. But some circumstance had placed us two together in a certain place, and this seemed to be necessary. The human mind cannot accept that there is another mind which is already preserving life unto eternity. And every thought we have about preserving our life is a denial of the Christ mind. There is a consciousness which knows that God, being all, God must be my life. I am the divine life. And the moment I take thought about protecting the divine life, I am denying myself to be the divine life, because divine life needs no protection. As I resist evil, I am saying I am not the divine life. And that's very fine for a reasoning, logical mind. But when I can face the evil with no need for protection, no need to defend myself, it will be because I have accepted that I am the divine life. And I will have accepted something else. Not only am I the divine life, but that which faces me in the role of evil is not. There is no evil on the earth in the realization that God is all. And so I face the evil, knowing there, behind the mask of evil, behind the distortion of the cosmic mind, is divine life. Here is divine life. And they are not separated. It only appears that way. Neither am I separated from God, nor that which seems to be evil. It may think it is separated from God, but it cannot be. No one and no thing is separated from God, because God is all. I, Spirit, am all. And whoever knows that his and her name is I, is asking in my name, and will receive. And this is the only protection you need against the so-called evils of this world. I, Spirit, am unseparated from God, and God is everywhere. There is no place in this universe where I am separated from God. Whoever would strike me must strike God. But, of course, if there's God and me, then I and the Father are no longer one in my consciousness, and I'm back into the Pharisee, the scribe, the human, the mortal who must die. Wherever you find yourself denying that God is all by calling someone else a scoundrel, you are losing your identity. That should be your signal. Before the word comes out of the tip of your tongue, and even before the thought comes into a word, pluck out the image in your mind. When you see the scoundrel, pluck out that I. Pluck out that image in your eye. Don't let it get so far that you become trapped into the belief that there is an evil person on the face of the earth. Or a sick one, or a dying one. This is Christ consciousness when you can look forth and say to the world, take up your bed and walk. There's no sickness there. There is only I, infinite I, invisible, functioning perfectly. And this is the only way we can learn to be perfect as our Father, in a righteousness that is not limited to the human sense of righteousness, but knows that I, Spirit, am unseparated from any individual on the face of the earth as well as God, because God and that individual are one and the same in the invisible self. There is no space or time to separate the identity of you from the identity of any individual who has ever lived or ever will. In reality, we are unseparated. And as long as we are unaware of that, we are in a divided consciousness which will know the things of this world and will not accept, receive, experience the fruits of oneness. And so we're looking now from the uplifted consciousness which sees that no war has ever killed the divine image and likeness of God. No hospital contains the divine image and likeness of God. No stillborn child, no blue baby, no mongoloid baby is the divine image and likeness of God. What about the good babies? Only in their invisible life is their reality. We are looking past the form. We are not sowing to the form. We are sowing to the spiritual reality which we have mentally interpreted into the appearance called form. We are following the Master. There's a great way, a great technique that you can develop to see past the images of this world. It may begin this way. Take a tree. You have the image of a tree. And here comes the woodman and he cuts it down. Did he cut down God's image or your mental image? Or here comes a fire and it burns it down. Did it burn down God's image or your mental image? So we see that the fire has burned our mental image. There is still an invisible tree right there. Now, how did the mental image of a tree come there? It came there because it had a witness who was in a false consciousness. It had a witness who was looking out through material eyes. God did not create matter. Material eyes cannot see the creation of God. And so how did this image get there? And this is a secret I'd like you to know. It is not one image. It is billions of images appearing as one. And when you can catch this, it will help you to stop those images. Let's look at it this way. Light is going through your eye, appearing to you as a tree. That light is moving so swiftly that you wonder how the brain can ever record what's happening. That isn't one image of a tree. That is billions and billions and billions and billions of images per second, one after the other, accumulating crushing one upon the other as they come through the eye with such infinite speed and such intensity that all of these individual images are compacted into one, which you call a tree. And the way you might understand it even better would be to look at your TV set. And there's an image on the TV set, a 21-inch image. Now, the way that got there is pretty much the same way you saw a tree. How did the image get on your TV set? If the program is in New York or Hollywood or Chicago, how could they ship a picture to your set? They didn't. They took a picture in the studio, and in order to ship it to your set, it had to be reconverted into electrical impulses. And those electrical impulses come through the air, one by one, but in great speed. And they hit your picture tube. And as they hit your picture tube, the electrical impulses are reassembled into a picture. The same way you talk on the phone. You can't send your voice to Chicago. As a matter of fact, if they were sending sound to Chicago, it would take quite a while before somebody there would hear you. They can't send the sound of your voice. They have to change that sound.